This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. Ava DuVernay got her start as a publicist. She directed her first feature when she was 38. Now, she's the highest-grossing Black woman director in American box office history. She's won BAFTA, Peabody, and Emmy Awards, and she's Oscar-nominated. Her work includes Academy Award-winning civil rights drama Selma, Oscar-nominated social justice documentary 13th, and the Disney children's adventure A Wrinkle in Time. She created, wrote, produced, and directed the Emmy Award-winning limited series When They See Us, based on the true story of five teens from Harlem falsely accused of a brutal attack in Central Park. She amplifies the work of Black artists, people of color, and women of all kinds through her multi-platform arts collective, Array. She sat down with Q-Tip, co-founder of A Tribe Called Quest and one of the most influential hip-hop figures of all time, at the 2015 Tribeca Film Festival. One small thing before we start. We don't actually have the audio of the audience questions that were asked during this conversation about writer's block, the male-dominated industry, assembling your team, and the next iconic female voices. We've included the questions in the episode notes in case you want to check them out.
What was the point? Because, you know, I don't want to, like, do the whole chronological start for you. But that moment when you made the transition to being a writer-director, what was it a series of things? Was it one thing in particular? Like, and what was the thing that happened that drove you to
Right. Well, I'm just thrilled. I met him 2 minutes ago as we were walking in. And as you're talking about kind of what drove me, as I'm looking at in your face, I keep thinking about the very first time that I got to do anything as an artist was as a UCLA student at this health food store called The Good Life in LA, where there were a bunch of really, I guess it's likened to your Lyricist Lounge here, back in the 90s. I feel old saying back in the 90s, right? But in the 90s, you know, the golden age of hip hop, and that was, you know, a time when I was a young poet, just in that world, and it was the first time that I was living with art, because where I came up, nobody was, you know, really thinking about art in that way. And so I directly related that to my first films, because my very first film was a film called This Is the Life, which was all about the good life.
Right.
And so that, you know, early time of living as an artist.
You guys should see it if you haven't, sorry.
Yeah, it's really, really underground cult classic.
Yeah.
But that early time, the time when I first got to just, you know, have creative energy around me and be with other artists every day and just what that vibe is, really fed me so much so that when I had the opportunity to make my first film, or I gave myself that opportunity, I chose to revisit that time. So I think, you know, when did the writing and directing come in? It really came in at the point when it was an alchemy, when there was a lot of creative energy around me. And I think that that's so important, you know, when you're starting out or even when you're doing it, to surround yourself.
Yeah.
Find a tribe. I didn't mean that. I did not mean that. Some people know I say find your tribe all the time. That was no pun intended. Truly. Truly. But find your people, you know, find the folks that are going to feed you and nourish you in a creative way. So I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it did. It did. And obviously, you know, Hollywood is notorious for a lot of things, and it's no secret, you know, it's hard for us as African Americans to gain entrance, and probably times that by 1,000 for Black women, especially Black women with vision and voice. Mm. How did you, I understand, you know, you spoke about, you know, your circle, your tribe, your circle of love and creativity that was around you. Because there was a period, because I think, between what was the I think it was maybe your second film, there was this period of inactivity, it may have seemed like, for 2 or 3 years. What was the longest period of inactivity, and was that ever due to you kind of like having to push your shoulder to the wheel and figure it out, like how much did that weigh on you and weigh on your artists?
Right. You know? Well, my motto is stay shooting, hashtag stay shooting. If I could tattoo it, I would. But my mom said no more tattoos. Yeah. So I'm always shooting. There's not been, since I started shooting, any period of inactivity. in general, there might be gaps in films,
right, okay.
but I'm doing TV, or I'm doing a doc, right. or I'm doing a commercial, or I'm doing a video.
Okay.
Constantly shooting is what the goal is. But yeah, I think for me, I started as a publicist in the industry.
Right, right.
So I was a publicist for a lot of filmmakers, and I would see the struggle, especially for Black filmmakers or people of color in general, and definitely women of color, this period of inactivity or this moment of trying to figure out, once you did it, how do you do it again mm-hmm. within the construct of the industry?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I made my first film, my first feature film, when I was 38.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never too late. That I just started from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never started work within the industry, within the architecture of the industry as we know it.
Right.
So I didn't come up to a lot of resistance because I found my people and I started making films in my own space, in my own way. Now,
right.
eventually those started to intersect with industry.
Right.
But that's, you know, the first four films,
yeah.
you know, were done completely independently,
right.
which is kind of the lifeblood of places like this, Tribeca and Sundance mm-hmm. and South by Southwest and Urban World and Langston Hughes and Pan-African Film Festival, mm-hmm. all of the places that that nurture that independent spirit. So I think, you know, that's one of the things that I learned from Spike. He was always shooting 20 films in 20 years,
yeah.
but also docs, but also commercials, but also music
stayed
videos, but
working.
Also
yeah,
plays. I mean, just
yeah.
stayed working and stayed shooting, and that makes the muscle strong.
Yeah.
But it also, you know, that creative energy that we're talking about,
yeah.
which is something I just really feel strongly about. You can't take it for granted once you have it.
Mm-hmm.
Like at Post Selma, folks were like, agents, some people were like, take your time, you know, make your next choice. Mm-hmm. Really think about what you want to do next. Take
you know
a year
what?
Off.
It's funny you say that, because it's like, for me, not to bring my thing in it, but for me, I find that once I start, I can't slow down, because it's like, you have to just keep, like you said, keep the muscle working.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you, like, look at Woody Allen. Like, Woody Allen has amassed this huge amount of work.
Yeah.
You know, like you spoke about Spike. It's like, you know, you have to, like, keep it going and not kind of let all the other things come in. And,
right. If you want to, I mean, don't overexert yourself to the point that you're damaged, but if you are living your dream, which I am,
mm-hmm.
and if you're in the thick of it and the window's open and the doors are wide open and you can breathe it in and do your thing, then why stop to make calculations about industry?
Right.
And
right.
so that's what was my thing after Selma. That's why I jumped into Jane Rosenthal, who introduced us, called and said, hey, do you want to come do a TV show? And folks were like, don't do a TV show. You were just at the Oscars. It's just like, I want to go shoot. You know what I mean? I'm trying to shoot and I like the show.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because, you know, it's a different process, you know, doing television and than film. Where do you feel like you have more freedom? Because sometimes with what I've noticed is that when you do film, you know, it's your undertaking. So you have all these other things that you probably have to think about. In a way, you're kind of like the quasi-producer. In a way, not only do you write, you direct, you're also acting. You're kind of just dealing with so much. Whereas with television, you kind of like working underneath somebody else's thing, in somebody else's paradigm, if you would. And that could also put you as a director in a real, you know, just working on that muscle specifically,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So which one do you feel
right.
you have more
right.
liberation in?
It's a great question. I think the goal is to find liberation in whatever you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and that's hard. But the interesting thing is right now, all the paradigms are changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, TV is not what it used to be. TV is now very much being embraced as an auteur's medium.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone from Steve McQueen to David Fincher to Soderbergh or Jill Soloway, I mean, great, great filmmakers are embracing television and making great stories. I mean, instead of a 2-hour film, they're making a 13-hour film.
Yeah.
But you're just seeing it weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how folks are approaching it. And that's how I've approached the series that I'm working on for OWN that I start shooting in the summer. But beyond that, you know, television in general, some of the episodic stuff I've done, like executive producing and creating the world for Jane's show, For Justice, or working on Shonda's show, Scandal. You are working in someone else's vision. Which
mm-hmm.
is interesting.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? I don't know if I can liken it to, I don't know, you do a guest verse on someone's song, see?
Yeah.
Trying to make it connect.
You're working with me.
I like it. But But, you know, I'm walking into their world and it's their decisions and you're trying to kind of get in where you fit in that space. So that's doing the episodic directing. Creating shows is its whole another thing. It's like film supersized.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like instead of 2 hours, it's 13 hours and I'm creating it and I'm writing it and I'm doing it and I'm just doing it and doing it and doing it because you're like, when is this shoot over? How many days is the shoot? Oh, 120-day shoot? Holy.
Right.
You know, so no, I think now television and film are really competing for the attention of writer directors now. And the other thing is once you start making films for studios, which I just had a little brush with on Selma, you know, I mean, I've never...
Speak.
Yeah, I'm about to do it. yeah. It was interesting because, you know, I'm used to writing, directing, producing my own stuff, putting my own crew together. No one is telling me anything.
Right, right.
Except, you know, answers to specific questions that I have from you.
Right.
Then I want to hear, what is your opinion? Tell me.
Right.
But tell me your opinion when
come
I haven't
now.
Asked
come
you
on.
Is the studio.
Come on now.
And so I think, you know, it was interesting to work in Selma. I did have Final Cut on Selma, so I always knew that the final vision would be mine, which is really rare. But you do have to work in a collaborative manner. It's interesting to work in a collaborative manner with people who might not be used to working in a collaborative manner.
And don't know what they're talking about. I said it.
Oh, you said it. You know, I mean, I think they know what they're talking about from their perspective, which is business.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, my perspective is from the creative side of it. And so sometimes those two don't mix. But you know, I'm finding the blurred lines between indie film, studio film, episodic television, creating your own television. It's all gray and it's all kind of wonderful.
Well, let me ask you, do you feel that, you know, as a director, as obviously one who's a cinephile, if such a thing, do you feel that everything being put on the small screen, do you feel like, do you have your own, I really like to see movies. Like, I like to go to the movies. I like to see things put in 2 hours. I like to see all that worked out. Or are you a person who, you know, obviously you understand what television is, but is there one medium that you prefer from the other? Do you feel like you just said it's a beautiful kind of gray? Do you feel like it's important to have differentiators? How do you feel about the fact that over the past maybe 10 years the television has just had kind of almost taken you know, Hollywood by storm? You know,
I think it's fantastic, and I'm trying to tell all kinds of stories. I was just talking to someone about VR, virtual reality. I'm trying to do one of those. You know, I'm trying to look, if I could skywrite a movie, I would. I mean, you know what I mean? Like all the new forms of storytelling is really what it is. I mean, I think there's something with filmmakers that we become very precious about film. You know, and just the sanctity, the sanctity of film.
Exactly.
But ultimately, it's about expression and your voice and the story and what you're trying to get across, the feeling, you know, the vibe, whatever you're trying to say. And I embrace that those things can be said and communicated in different ways.
As a director, do you feel, and I want to talk to you about your cinematographer choices, specifically for Selma, because I just thought it was just so beautiful to look at, right? Like, wasn't it? I'm speaking, being candid with you, being that we're intimate here, and I'm just being honest, so don't take it wrong, but sometimes some people don't know how to capture African-Americans or Blacks or people of color on film. You know what I mean? Sometimes they make people look muted in a certain way. You get it, you know, you understand?
He means ashy. The white people are saying that.
No, yes. But so it's kind of like a multi-tiered question.
Yeah.
But having the ability to paint and, you know, in the composition of certain shots, you know, as a director, you look at it and you see how it's framed out. And then you kind of thinking cinematically, you're thinking how it looks on a big screen. And not to beat the whole TV thing in the head, but it may seem for some people a challenge of how you can have that same kind of, like when you actually make it and composing that shot, how it will look on television.
Sure.
Do you feel like that's a hindrance for you? Do you look at that as a challenge as a challenge as a director? do you look at as a bad, like,
how? It's a great question. Well, I have to give a shout out to anybody. I mean, you know, I'm gonna say Bradford Young. Now I'm gonna say Bradford. So you need to know this brother named Bradford Young, who is my cinematographer extraordinaire. They would vibe. If anybody knows Bradford or knows about Bradford, I think they'd have a good time together hanging out. But anyway, he's a good brother, and he is a genius when it comes to the photographic image, particularly the cinematic image, and particularly around how we capture our tonality and skin tones and all of that, which is a very specific conversation that we have ad nauseum every day we're on the set.
It's important.
Always. I always say, in my film Middle of Nowhere, we were playing with the idea of how Black people look in dark rooms. You know, when I go in my house at night, the light's not on, and what does that look like? And so often folks are afraid to put darker hues against darker backdrops because it's just going to be teeth and eyes. You know what I mean? And that's not necessarily the case. And sometimes it is the case, and it's beautiful. And so really playing with all of that texture and all of that tone and what that means to deconstruct it and experiment with it. So we did that a lot on previous things. This is our fourth project we worked on together. So with Selma, it was just so deeply embedded in our, love of our people, the legacy of the civil rights movement, but then also just, we really were always playing with the idea of the Black body and deconstructing that in all kinds of ways. So we were very rigorous with our use of close-up, with our use of profile. We like just a little bit of a rim of light just on the profile. You may not be able to see everything. There's a whole scene where there's two dark men, David Oyelowo and Coleman Domingo, sitting in a dark jail cell.
Right, there's just a little
peek of light. And it's a funny story. That was our first day of shooting. So that was the first day to go to the studio. And they were like, no joke, ordered extra dailies, colorists, to go in and had money set aside to reshoot it. And me and Brad are like, that's what it's supposed to look like. Right, you know what I mean? Right. And eventually that's in the film. But, no disrespect to them, but that image, just the image of two dark-skinned people sitting in a dark space was so startling and rare that it needed extra dailies colorists, just to see is there information there? They call it information. Like, if we want to turn it up, can we? You know what I mean? And Brad was like, yeah, there's information in there. And the information was like the tip of the nose. Like you could when you cranked it up, you could see like that. They were like, but I mean, the idea of, it translating that kind of photographic experimentation with how that really related to the narrative. I mean, at that point in jails in the mid 60s in the deep South, wasn't no pretty light coming in the window. What I mean? Like, how do you make that real? How do you make it dank? How do you make it feel like our reference was making it feel like the hull of a slave ship? Like, that was what we were trying to do. And so to do that, you can't be like giving them an extra fill. You have to just go for it. Yeah. The beauty light. Yes.
Staying on Selma for a minute.
We all know what's going on in America currently. It's been kind of happening. It's not new for us, but I think technology has caught up to the deeds of the police. So it's just everybody else is finding out about it. Like just last night, I was reading this morning in the Times that there was a 25-year-old, I don't know if you guys heard about this, in Baltimore.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Freddie Gray.
Yeah, who had his spine broken. He was running away from the cops.
Well, he wasn't even running away from the cops. He was just running. They weren't pulling him over for anything.
Yeah.
Brother saw some cops and was like, I'm gonna go this way.
I'm just gonna go over here. Yeah.
And they saw him running and so pursued.
Yeah.
And then he ends up with a broken vertebrae and a vocal box smashed and died in a coma a week later.
Yeah.
But they arrested him and he was cool when they put him in the van, so they don't really know how that happened.
Yeah.
The six cops in the back of the van. But anyway.
When you were making Selma, did you have, what was your intent? I mean, obviously there's the creative and artistic, but just surreptitiously, was it something that was just bubbling under, speaking to where we are now as Blacks in America with how we're valued, how our lives are valued or lack thereof. Actually, the irony, I think, in a way, you know, African-American woman who's leading this artistic charge, speaking about like a great moment in American history, but then it colliding with what's happening today. Mm-hmm. Was all of that stuff like, you know, swirling around?
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever any moments on top of that? Was there ever any moments when you were on set or you were doing something that was really emotional that kind of like triggered a whole bunch of thoughts or emotions about where we are today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this Mike Brown was murdered while we were in the editing room. So we had already shot the scene of Jimmie Lee Jackson being murdered in Selma in the restaurant. And that's just historical. I mean, you said it at the top. It's not new.
Mm-hmm.
It's only now being captured and amplified for a national audience.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as Black people in America, certainly coming from where I come from in Compton and just in general, I mean, we know that this stuff is an ongoing thing. So bring that into every thought about how we were going to construct Selma was definitely at the forefront, but it wasn't directly connected to any of these cases that have now garnered national attention. I wasn't thinking of Oscar Grant or anyone in particular. I was just thinking of what my mission is in all of my work truly is to, you know, magnify the magnificence of Black people, which is basically a longer way to say that Black Lives Matter, really, before the hashtag. That was my goal, was just in all of my work, you know, if we don't do it, who's going to do it? If the woman filmmaker doesn't take special care with the woman characters, who does it? Because it's not going to be the man. If the Black filmmaker doesn't take special care with it, who's going to do it? It's not going to be the filmmaker who doesn't know it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's some instances where special things shine through, but overall, I feel that it's no one else's responsibility to make the things that I want to see. It's my responsibility, and if I want to see them, then I need to make them if I'm able, and I am, so I do. But yes, within Selma, you know, it was interesting. We were dealing with the echoes and the legacy of all of this trauma. And, you know, while we were in the editing room, it started to manifest in national headlines in a way that we could have never imagined. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I hope that people went into the film with a sense of urgency and immediacy about what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. I think if anything good came from the time that the film came out, what was going on in the nation was that people were watching the film not with a sense of hindsight.
Right.
But with a sense of Selma is now and this is then and nothing's changed and wait, how far have we come? And those questions were not in a box with the patina of civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
which is what we wanted to avoid.
Yeah.
It just feels, you know, like Black people trying to live and breathe, whether it's then or whether it's now.
Right. I mean, you know, just from one artist to another, for me, and again, not trying to take it away, but I feel like our work is so kind of like intertwined.
You do? Wow.
No, I do.
That's great.
I do. I mean, you love hip hop. You came up,
I know.
You know what I'm saying? Hip hop birthed you, hip hop birthed
you. I really love hip hop.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And I feel like.
Yes.
No, nah, but I feel like, you know, where we're at musically, it's like, like you said, it's important to, I say this a lot to like my team, you know, it's important to show and highlight, you know, Black brilliance, but also Black complexity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't always have to be positive.
In music, and especially in our music, from what we're kind of doled out,
mm-hmm.
like immediately, it's only it's a very myopic kind of presentation. It's like, we are existing as musically as people with money and opulence and grandiose and not giving a fuck and I'll shit and I'll blame, you know, the same old things.
Right.
And it just, it's really, I wish that that sentiment that you shared could be funneled and fueled in a bigger way. Musically, you know what I mean?
What do you see now? I mean, what music, I mean, certainly that's what you do and what you've done, but I mean, what do you think of is the state of things now? Because it's always been that element of the bling and the violence and that thing.
That's
but you're saying there's not a comprehensive view of who we are.
Well, I think that there's people out there that's making stuff. Mm-hmm.
But it's
not certainly
being.
But it's not. And I think because of that, some people who have the chops and the wherewithal to kind of make more meaningful, deeper type of music tend to say,
right.
Bills, I gotta pay bills.
Right, right.
Fuck the bitch.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So,
right. But the same thing. Same thing with film. I mean, you know, we know the things that sells, and as far as being a Black filmmaker, it's comedy, it's action. You know, it's those elements. The quiet character drama. Mm-hmm. You know, is not what the studios are paying you for. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're never gonna get rich off of it. Just like you're saying,
right.
The MC that tries to speak about certain things will be relegated to a certain place. I think the question as artists is, is it worth it? I mean, what, you know what I mean? Is it worth not the time when you could say something and actually monetize it, and you know what I mean? And it not monetize it, but it be embraced by an audience big enough for you to live was, you know, was the time when Tribe was at its height.
Mm-hmm.
Could Tribe come out right now and hit? What do you think?
No,
you do not think. Say, okay, wait. Midnight Marauders drops right now. What happens? He would buy it. He got one. One, you got two, three sales in the room.
I think that we weren't really, at those times, there was no compromise with us. We had a vision. And we just went, you know what I mean? And it was such a young, still fertile time, you know? America was still kind of, and this is just in total, America was still getting, you know, still being able to look at Black life, whether it be through hip hop, through film, through sports, whether it was Michael Jordan, whether it was Martin Lawrence, or Tribe, or Far Side. You know, most of America was still saying, wow, they really, you know what I mean? So, and we weren't really concerned. It was more of an end thing. So there was no compromise. But I guess the point I'm getting to is there is a time where you may have to look at it and you say, I may have to compromise this. I may have to compromise that. How important is it for you as a director, as an artist, to look at these things that may come up in front of you that you may feel be roadblocks to where you're trying to go? Do you truly look at it as a compromise, or do you look at it as a challenge? Like, I'm trying to see if you look at it, if something comes to you and it's totally like gnarly and something you don't want to do, do you try to find this? Are you the type of person to try to find the silver lining in it and try to work it towards where you're at? Or do you just like say no?
Right. No, I just say no. Because it's too hard. I mean, making a film is hard. I mean, you know, some of you in here have done it or are trying to do it. It is, you know, two nights ago, I mean, Jane's shaking her head. I mean, I was just in the sound mix. I had a sound mix going, a VFX session going. The composer was in the other room. The editor's in the room. It's three in the morning.
How many hours?
Three in the, I mean, we're...
Were you working at that point?
Seven all... I mean, when I say seven all-nighters, that means go home, take a shower, you like, get a quick meal, maybe 2 hours, and go
and
back.
And go right back.
Because we were on a crazy deadline. But it's too hard, the way that I make films, it's too hard to do something...
That you don't love, if you ain't in it.
If there's something that you don't love in it.
Right,
it's just, there's just no amount of money. Like, for example, on this piece that I was doing, this pilot, I'm on set, I'm feeling good, I really like this piece. There's something in the piece that I want to say. There's something in this piece that I want to be on television. It's about this elite group of freedom fighters. They work for the DOJ, and they're a combination of lawyers and FBI agents, and every week they solve a different civil rights abuse. So it's like every week the country would be able to see a case solved about anti-Muslim sentiment, or a case solved that's something around Ferguson, or a case solved that's something around a transgender murder, or whatever. But these elements in the umbrella of a procedural, you're actually able to give middle America or whomever's watching some information about people on the outside, people on the margins, right? And so I love the idea of that. But at the point that it's 2 in the morning, I'm in New York in a snowstorm doing a night exterior. I'm thinking, there's no amount of money.
Right.
Like, where's Jane? I need a raise. You know what I mean? Like, this, why am I here? What? And so, and what the answer was, is because I have to tell the story. But if the answer was because you need a check, there's no amount of money to do something you don't want to do. So yeah.
Y'all hear that, students?
I'm used to not having a lot of money. So, Word. And you know, making Word. Stuff indie. So, yeah. You know, I mean, what do you really need besides
being married to your vision?
Yes, you know? I mean, being very, you know, in a loving, happy marriage with your vision, yes, mm-hmm. is yeah. a good thing to be. To be very, you know what I mean? Just like very, you know, in love with what you're doing. I think that's the key. And I think people can tell, the audience, you know, something about the energy with which things are made is transmitted to the audience. Mm-hmm. I can watch a film and tell if it's made with joy.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Or made with some passion, mm-hmm. made with some... the spirit of that artist or the artists who came together. I can watch a film and some of that transfers to you.
Yeah.
The very best films are that way, I think.
Who are some of your favorite directors?
I am a big Ang Lee fan. Mm. I'm a big Haile Gerima fan, Julie Dash. You know, to say you're a fan of black filmmakers, unfortunately, is to say that you're a fan of maybe two or three films.
Yeah.
Because we're not, you know, we don't have a Woody Allen.
Right.
Or Mike Nichols, mm-hmm. or, you know, our filmmakers are not making films into their old age
right.
with all of the wisdom and experience that they've garnered. That's a truly sad thing. I mean, our greats, Haile Gerima, you mm-hmm. know, Julie Dash, mm-hmm. Charles Burnett, mm-hmm. Ezeun Palsy, they're mm-hmm. not making films right now because
mm-hmm.
they can't. They cannot get it together. They cannot get the support and resources together mm-hmm. to continue to have their voices heard in this time of their life when there's so much for us to hear.
Yeah.
So when you look at, you know, Sidney Lumet was making films until, you know, couldn't make them anymore.
Right.
And so that is the comment on not just black filmmakers, but filmmakers of color in general in this country.
Yeah.
There's no long legacy for any of our filmmakers for us to be able to see them mature into their later years
yeah,
and
that's
get the benefit of it.
That's a shame too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's maybe the new, I mean, who's next? Like, first of all, it's not too late for us to support these filmmakers and mm-hmm. for them to be able to make their films. But Julie Dash has a crowdfunding campaign going right now, Julie Dash on Indiegogo. And that sister should be able to make another feature film since Daughters of the Dust.
Right.
That was shot crazy.
Who was the cinematographer in it?
Arthur Jaffa.
AJ.
Who was Bradford Young.
Crazy.
Bradford Young, my cinematographer. Oh. That's his teacher. Did you know AJ?
Yeah, I know AJ.
He shot on Summer.
Oh, he did?
He was our second camera.
Really?
Yeah.
He's dope. AJ, I know he shot, Kubrick got him to do Eyes Wide Shut for a little bit.
Yeah, he's bad.
Sorry.
Side note, AJ, Arthur Jaffa, look him up too. AJ actually directed a film, a documentary, a really beautiful doc mm-hmm. that he's working on called Dreams Are Colder Than Death.
Mm.
Damn, I want to see that.
Oh, man.
It's a good film. So anyway, just the idea of legacy around our filmmaking is something that's really important. And so I think part of that is loving what you do, trying to create a canon of material. Not to say I'm immune to any kind of pressures. There's a project right now that, there's a couple projects that have been floating around.
Yeah, please, speak on what you got. Like,
no,
up, please.
No.
As much as you can.
There's projects out there that on the face would look like that's never something that she would do. But there's something about it that, you know, that I think speaks to what I want to say. So I think we need to keep ourselves open to that as well, the unexpected, and to taking different turns. You know, when Spike started directing, he would do, when he did Kings of, didn't he? No, not Kings of Comedy. He did something crazy. I remember the first time was it?
What, She Hate Me?
Kings of Comedy? No. When he just, what was it? Who? Kings of Comedy? Yeah, he did Kings of Comedy, and he's, he started doing like live concert, and you think of him as one thing. You know, if you take away all of Spike's narrative films, and you just look at his docs and live work, like that is the work of like a whole nother filmmaker's career. Just right. the docs,
right.
you know, just the live stuff, just the commercials. Mm-hmm. I know I continue to reference him, but I do it because he took left turns and he did what interested him and he didn't keep himself in any kind of box. He just continued to shoot and follow his interests.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that's also something that I want to make sure I try to stay flexible and not get, you know, after Selma, I don't know, like 9 civil rights scripts landed on my desk. And I'm like, no civil rights, I'd say. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, no civil rights. How about this? This takes place in the 20s, racism. This is the first fighter pilot of this. This is, I said, okay, well, how about this? No civil rights for a minute.
Yeah, right.
No period pieces.
Right.
No
right,
first
right.
of anything.
Right.
What else is out there? Crickets. Right. You know what I mean? Like, right. there's not a lot else happening that's coming across the desk at this point. So.
Yeah.
The romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. You were in a romantic comedy, weren't you?
I was.
Weren't you?
I forgot.
Yeah.
I'm sure you forgot too.
No, you were in a good romantic comedy. Weren't you in something my friend Gina Bryce?
Oh yeah.
You were the cool producer.
Disappearing acts.
Yeah, with Sanan Wesley. She was trying to make a song, but the producer wouldn't. What, you wouldn't give her tracks? You locked up her tracks or something? And then
had this big kung fu fight. And I beat his ass all over the frame.
Right. No, I remember that. You don't want to act anymore? Why don't you act?
I'm waiting for you.
Don't say it. Don't say it. I have witnesses. But is that of interest though?
Yeah, definitely.
Was this a dabbling? Because at one point, every MC was like, I'm going to get my
act on. Can I speak of it? Because this is a thing that people probably, it's some inside thing, right? Yeah. So I came up in this crew, the Native Tongues, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my close buds was this guy, Africa, who was in this group, the Jungle Brothers.
How he's talking about it like we don't know any of these.
Well,
okay.
He was actually, and my manager here, Mike Austin, sitting in front. They did this film, and it was the first film that featured a rapper, and he starred in it, and I can't remember it. The dude who was in, what's the Queen Latifah, Living Single? The dude who is the dark-skinned dude with the dreads, and he was like...
Oh, T.K. Carter.
Yeah, and what was the name of that movie that he was in with?
Oh, Nina. Nina Shaw's right in the middle. You probably represented that movie and the people in it.
I can't remember, but it...
T.K. Carson, one of those... T.C. Living Large?
Living Large.
T.C. Carson.
Well, Africa was in this movie.
A classic, as we
He was in this movie.
Okay.
This is before Pac did it. And he and I used to talk about doing film and all that stuff and wanting to do film and all that stuff. And then I got a call from John Singleton, and he wanted me to do the lead in, what was the movie I was... See,
Poetic Justice?
Yeah. He wanted me to do the lead, but I was like, nah, I can't do it. Just give me a small part. He was like, you sure? Because I'll give you the smallest part ever. I said, yeah, give me the smallest part ever. And he gave me the small
part.
No, like,
but it was
purpose.
The best part. Weren't you the boyfriend who died?
Yeah, no, he gave me the small part.
At the drive-in? Weren't you at the drive-in? Oh, now I remember. I haven't thought about that scene since this very minute.
Was like that.
But no, because it was important. Let me tell you why from a filmmaker's perspective. Justice, Janet Jackson with the Dookie Brains, if anybody remembers. Justice was devastated. Why? You had to give her a reason to be devastated. If you're gonna lose this, you're gonna be devastated for the whole movie. It can't be someone you're shaking, be like, girl, get over it. Like, we were with her in her, you know, she was like looking at your picture or whatever was happening.
So but in both instances, I felt like,
I like that movie.
I felt, you see how I'm talking through that. But in both instances, you know, I felt like, man, I had it, but I didn't do it. Like, I've always, and this is like a fault of mine, I had like this youthful preoccupation with trying to be the first to do it. I was young and stupid, whatever.
Right.
I didn't know much. So then after I did it, Fishburne, who was dear big brother to me, I seen him. They did a test of it or whatever, or he seen it or something. I ran into him. He was like,
"You're good."
I was like, he says, "You think I'm lying to you?" And he got really serious. He's like, "If I'm telling you you're good, you're good. Mm. You should think about doing it for real.
Good fish
but you
impression.
Need to."
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a ton of them. Yeah. No, but he was like, "You need to study."
Mm-hmm. Did you?
So I did. Okay. I went to HB here. Yeah. Yep, I went to HB. I also studied at Black Nexus with Susan Batson for a few years. So I studied at HB for like 2 years, and I studied with Susan for like 3 or 4 years. And then somebody went like this to the bodega gate, and all the rappers came running through. And so then I was like, I'm gonna do beats and just rap.
So it was because it was getting too crowded in the space, it wasn't being taken seriously?
Yeah, but then I had this idea to do this thing about, you know, young men getting incarcerated. So I came up with an idea, and I wrote it along with Darnell Martin, who's another talented.
Yeah, beautiful. Mm-hmm. Beautiful sister.
It was gonna be a musical, and it's not really music, but not really like a breakout, like, "Oh, I'm in prison,"
right.
type thing.
Right, right.
But like, you know, we was gonna like try to do it, and it was called Prison Song. And Jane at Tribeca and Bob took a liking to it and bought it, and we did it at New Line, and it didn't really go anywhere. But you know, it was fun because I got to.
You made it.
Scrape. Yeah, it was something you made, you know, and you got to scrape your elbows a little bit and kind of bruise your knees a little bit and get in and do it. But yeah, it's something that, especially when you see work like yours, that you know, like, all of this great amount of work and sweat went into it, but when you see the piece, you don't see the work. Like, I mean, you don't see the mechanics. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
For me, I don't like when I look at a film and I can see that it's directed. Like, you shouldn't even, sometimes certain directors who are awesome directors, they get into doing these little tricks and then they just throw it in and you know it's them sometimes and it becomes caricature, it becomes kind of sloppy. Mm. I like kind of, for me personally, a seamless kind of like integration of what you're trying to do as a director and how you're melding with the stories and the characters. Mm-hmm. How much time do you spend working with the actors? Because it seems like that you're a director who cares about that. I noticed that you use certain cats throughout your films. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like when you have an actor and you have a synergy with them, you know, certain directors are like, you know, just read the line, I put the camera there, I wrote it this way. Certain directors, like a Spike, likes to rehearse 2-3 weeks before. Like, what is your place with the actors?
Well, I love actors. I think there's some directors who just truly, truly don't love actors. Mm-hmm. They love the camera more, which is not a bad thing. And when I sit down and talk to directors, I'll ask them, if you had to choose, Sophie's Choice, the camera, if you could make a film with no actors, would you? You know what I mean? Or if you could make a film with no camera, would you? And so for me, it's all about the actors. I really love working with actors. I have a deep respect for them because I could never do it. And so when I'm asking an actor to do something or to say something or to give a part of themselves, I'm asking them to do something that I'm not brave enough to do myself. And so I have respect for that. And no, I just enjoy collaborating and building and shaping a character with another artist. The challenge is that on independent films, there's no time, there's not a lot of time to rehearse. Mm-hmm. But I always like to just kiss it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So we can't have a full session, but we can just have a kiss, you know, just kiss the scene, just a quick, are we on the same page about what this is before you get to
what
set?
What does kiss it mean?
You know, it can happen in a bunch of different ways. It can happen with just a conversation about it. It can happen with, you know, just reading it and just seeing how it feels out in the world, the words feel out in the world. Maybe if there's enough time, you try to get it on its feet and get some movement around it. Just different rehearsal techniques, but ultimately, it's about making sure that we both have a similar idea of what the scene is before we get there on the day, so that we're being time efficient on the day and not trying to work out major problems on the set, which is tough.
But I mean, because at a certain point, I'm sure if you hadn't already, you may run into actors who may feel like kind of like the adverse of what directors feel like that they're the ones who really are carrying it. There's some actors who are notorious for
I don't cast them. I try to cast and invite people to work with me who have the same attitude about the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, those actors are known, the ones that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And usually you can sit down with someone and get a sense of their vibe. A couple have slipped through. Mm-hmm. But I'm not afraid to tell you how I feel.
That's good.
At any point set. So I just really don't tolerate bad behavior, and I don't think that the actor is above the grip or above the other crew members.
And I was about to ask you
about. So if somebody's acting a fool or acting up, you know, I'm like, that guy was on set 2 hours before you even got here. He's going to be here two hours, and you, out of respect, we need to get this down. But I think, you know, you try to create a familial quality on the set, and part of that is the way that you curate the people that you work with. I know early on when I was working, it's so much about who will work for me and with me for no money. They didn't have any. But ultimately, what I found is that's never worth it. You know what I mean? It's always because you're going to have bad apples and bad energy on set.
Right.
So keep the crew smaller and make sure that no matter what you're doing, you have people who want to be there and who you want to be there with, because it's too hard to be doing.
I mean, you're not just directing the film. You're directing the crew, the set, the everything. It's like even down to like craft services.
Yeah.
You know, you have to make sure that everybody... It's cool.
Well, you're directing an experience.
Yeah,
that's how I see it.
You know what I mean?
The experience of it. Yes, we're making the film, and that is what lives on from this experience that we've all had.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really don't like people to leave any kind of work with me feeling like that was a waste of time or that was a bad experience. Or I feel bad about that time I gave. Because they're giving their time, they're giving their talent. So I think I'm trying to create a overall experience. It's like you're throwing a house party. You just want all the elements.
Yo, can I tell you? I went to go visit Leo on Django.
Oh, Leo.
So he was you know, he's like, that's my.
That's your boy. We know him as Leonardo.
Yeah.
That's what we know him as. But we know who you mean.
So I went to visit him, right? So they were doing the scene where they come into Candyland, whatever. So Jamie's there, he's kicking it, whatever. So then they break or whatever. And in between scenes, Tarantino is playing like Cream and James Brown. Everybody on the crew is just like happy. It's hot as hell. You could tell they've been busting the ass.
Right.
And then when they had to break the scene down to set up another scene, he's like, okay, what's the real? Because we're close to 100. Okay, 100. So it was 100, I guess, 100 reels or something like that. So he had like this whole margarita thing come out, and they were playing music, drinking margaritas, everybody, like everybody out there. You know what I mean?
Nice.
So it was just, it was crazy. And I was like, I just didn't understand how he could go work without being drunk. And, because they was heavy-handed.
Right.
But it was, to your point, you know, it's an experience. And I think, like you said earlier, it shows up on the screen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sure. Yeah. And it totally shows up in all your work. Uh-huh. The joy, the connection to the work. Your heart is in it.
Thank you.
And your fearlessness is in it. You just feel it. It's just really beautiful. It's a subtlety that you have, but it's powerful.
Thank you.
You know?
Appreciate that.
And
thank you. Likewise.
I hope that, you know, I hope that you rushing over here wasn't
it was very much worth it. Is that it?
No, we're going to open up.
Are we going to do questions?
We're going to do some questions.
Okay, cool.
I just wanted to get my leg.
What a pleasure.
Brother just wanted to,
Fantastic. Appreciate it. Thank you. Very much worth
it. So we're going to take some questions from folks. This young lady right here in the blue.
I really am renowned for hating writing. really, it's it's bad. Like, I have writer's block really bad. I have writer's block right now. I'm on deadline. And they think I've written some stuff. It's not as far along as it should be, truly. And so I'm struggling with that. What I found, I'm just going to be honest and real with you, it is that procrastination, I've embraced it. And embraced it as a part of the writing process. I'm not ready to write right now. You know what I mean? And it's going to get done. And it's going to get done when it should. But there's something about, for me, the hectic energy of the end of it that really pushes me forward. And for me, that it, the lesson in that is everybody's different. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Ryan Coogler, a friend of mine, one time I called him. Yes, he's brilliant. He's brilliant. One time I called him. Where are you? What are you doing? Oh, at the coffee shop, writing. It's like, are you on deadline? What's up? What are you doing? No, just, you know, getting my ride on, having a good day, got my coffee. Like, what is it, something specific you're writing? Oh yeah, that thing I was telling you about. Like, it's going well, got pages. Like, just, and I'm just like when I'm writing, like it's the dead of night, it's due in 2 days, like I'm stressed out. So everyone's different. The end, he makes a nice thing, I make a nice thing. How we get to it is different. How you'll get to it will be different. The other thing I'll say for me, writer's block, is I can't write well alone. I like to be like he was in a coffee shop. I find most writers, or a lot of writers, it helps to have energy around you. It helps me. Or yeah, judging, like the judgment helps. But yeah, like coffee shops or public places, or like, you know, or library, or just another writer in the room helps me. Good luck. There's no one way. I think for me, because I started in another career first, that I was able to go in this career with a little bit more fuck you, you know what I mean? Because like, I knew I was good at something else. Like it wasn't, you know, and I've been in a lot of these rooms, male-dominated rooms before, so I didn't really have a fear of saying no, or I didn't have a fear of asking the question, or I didn't have a fear of just saying, this doesn't work for me, I'm gonna leave and do it myself. And so the only thing I can say is, and I say this all the time, is there's nothing to ask permission for, don't ask for permission. Half of us are waiting for permission, someone to say it's okay, someone to say do it, someone to say that's a good idea, someone to give you the money, someone to give you the resources. That's all working from a permission-based way. When I just decided I'm just gonna work with what I've got and give myself the permission, then it really started. And I mean, beyond that, I just don't embrace the whole, the men thing being a block for me. Because I always know that I mean, how's anybody gonna stop me from making my thing? Like, it's not possible that you can stop me from making. It is not possible that I'm not gonna make a film. It's just not in the realm of possibility. So I think, you know, you just gotta start. You just gotta begin. Like, that was the biggest thing for me. Once I started, I never stopped. But the starting was the hard part. Mm. You know, just beginning with what you have. And I would say that's the biggest tip, is just start. It may not be the dream project, it may not be perfect. Begin, whatever it is, if it's the writing, if it's the acting, if it's the directing, producing, whatever it is you wanna do, just get started. Yeah. Good question. No, I didn't know any of those people. I didn't know any of those people before I Will Follow. I had a script and I had passion. And the unfortunate thing that's fortunate for Black filmmakers is Black actors aren't working. And if you ask them and you have a piece of material that resonates with them and they can see in your eyes that you're dead serious, they will come. Because there's, you know, the complexity of the roles are not there. And Sally Richardson's the lead of that film. No one's coming to her with the leads in films and a quiet movie that's about the heart of a Black woman. I mean, she made nothing on that movie. At one point she was like, Ava, these craft services are not sufficient. I was like, what? We've got cereal? We've got the bag? What's the issue? It was a $50,000 film. At some one point, she came out of pocket to like finance the craft services department. She actually put money into that movie to tell that story. All of those people, I didn't know any of them. But it is really just about the asking and about the material. If you've got a good script and it is complex, you know, it doesn't have to be all positive, the complexities of who we are. I say Black actors will come, but I think, you know, many actors of all stripes just want to do good work, so. Just ask. And now with social media, I mean, just DM him. And, well, you're not. You know, I don't Twitter very much, but you can reach people now. You know, the usual walls to getting to folks, so those are collapsing as well. So, I mean, yes, we've had some women make things. I mean, Agnes Varda, Nora Ephron, Nancy Meyer. I mean, I've named three, though. It's not enough, you know? It's not enough. So I think, you know, there's an ageism in Hollywood that makes it difficult for filmmakers to, I mean, I think, isn't story Sidney Lumet on his last film had to be shadowed by somebody? They made someone, I can't remember who, some young filmmaker who was a fan of his and a lover of his, took time out of their career to be on that set because insurance wouldn't insure him to make that film. So it, you know, it's tough all around, but when we look at legacy and we look at the resources given, yeah, people of color, women, really tough. So I intend to be with the cane. Action. An old, you know, what a blessing if we're able to still do whatever we want to do when we're old. I mean, that's not old, it's just in the time of life when you can take it all in and present it in a way that we can't now. And so I look forward to that. I hope I make it there. But I intend to be calling action and cut with my cane. So, yeah.
Well, I guess we'll call cut on this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilm.com.